This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. President-elect Trump said recently he doesn't like what's happened with drug prices and promised to bring them down. And many Americans would cheer such a move, especially those who pay huge amounts of money for life-saving medicines. But lowering drug costs first requires agreement on why they're so high, and that's an argument. It also requires going up against powerful forces, including pharmaceutical companies and Congress, which, for all its public outrage, has made several policy choices that have helped push costs up. Today in The Exchange, the price of prescriptions. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests joining us from D.C. who've been following this for a long time. Sarah Cliff is with us. She's senior editor at Vox.com, where she oversees health, medicine, and education coverage. Sarah's also a former reporter with The Washington Post. And Sarah Cliff, great to have you. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also with us from D.C., Sydney Lupkin, correspondent for Kaiser Health News, covering drug prices and specializing in data reporting. And Sydney's a former health reporter for ABCNews.com. And Sydney, welcome to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's bring this down to the average person. You know, with decent health insurance, you go to the drugstore, Sydney. Sometimes you pay almost nothing. Other times you can't believe how much the pharmacist is asking you for. Why is this, Sydney?
Basically, it's a complicated problem. The first reason is because in the U.S., drug manufacturers set their own prices. There isn't a body like in Europe or in Australia, as Sarah Cliff, I'm sure, will say later, that says, okay, well, you want this drug to be used here, and this is how much you want for it. Well, we don't know that really is a cost that, you know, fits how good this drug is. So, you know, we're not accepting that price. We don't have any kind of negotiating like that here. The biggest, you know, public kind of body that we have is Medicare. And in 2003, when Medicare Part D was created, Congress explicitly said you can't negotiate drug prices. So that's one reason. The other reason is because we have these little government-protected monopolies, which also sort of help keep drug prices high for things like orphan drugs, which sort of extend the life of a drug's patent. The other reason, and this is a big one, is that the FDA takes a very long time to approve generic drugs, which typically lower the cost significantly. I think as soon as there are two generic drugs on the market, that lowers the cost of the drug by 55%. And then the more generics, the lower the price gets. So if we aren't approving generics very quickly, then we don't have them available to bring those prices down. So those are, I think, a good, you know, first three reasons to get into.
Well, and we'll have a lot to get into with that for sure. But so, Sydney, for all the hyperventilating that we saw in Congress last year about high drug prices and EpiPen and, you know, sad stories about families who were struggling to afford life-saving medicines, Congress should be looking in the mirror, Sydney, to some extent with this?
Well, part of it is even on the state level, there are sort of well-intentioned laws that sometimes will you know, not work out in our favor in terms of limiting costs. For instance, on the state level, there are 26 states that basically have rules against subbing out generics without, you know, explicit orders from doctors or consent of patients. And we know that generics save the healthcare system a lot of money.
So some states discourage doctors from handing out generics.
Right.
Sounds like about half of them.
Yeah, I think actually I looked up New Hampshire before I got on the call. New Hampshire, these are usually called dispense as written laws. Mm-hmm. And in New Hampshire, if your doctor wants to prescribe a brand name, they have to write on the prescription medically necessary underneath of it. But they allow substitutions for generics, which is, you know, a good thing. Some states in New England require generic switching if, for instance, the drug costs less. But I don't think New Hampshire has that.
So, Sarah Cliff, I want to bring you into this, and specifically to Sydney's first point that drug manufacturers here set their own prices. And, you know, at first glance, that sounds fine, right? I mean, car makers set their own prices and shampoo makers set their own prices. So why not let drug makers set their own prices, Sarah?
Yes, I think the argument here is that drugs are really different from shampoo or from cars or from anything else we buy. If we don't get the fancy shampoo, if we don't get the new car, we'll probably still live, right? Like, we'll still be okay, whereas with drugs, that's not really a choice we often have, that these are often matters of life and death. With, for example, EpiPen, which was in the headlines recently, if, you know, those with peanut allergies don't have EpiPen, they go into anaphylactic shock, that's really a matter of life and death, whether they have access to that medication. So there's a lot less discretion on the part of the shopper in terms of when they buy these products, how much they're willing to spend. And so that's why you see most other developed countries, they think that drugs are important enough that they should be regulated like a utility. And this is really a way that the United States is exceptional, where we don't do that. We don't tell drug manufacturers how much they can charge. And as a result, you have, you know, a lot of drugs that get priced out of affordability for most Americans. And, you know, if that's an expensive car, that's fine. We don't think it's a problem that, you know, all Americans can't afford a BMW. But there is a lot more on the line when Americans can't afford certain life-saving medications.
Well, so how do other countries do it, Sarah? For example, in your article on this, you looked at Australia. So just walk us through that, please.
Yeah, so Australia has an agency. So when you want to sell a drug in Australia, first you have to get it approved by a scientific committee that says it's safe, it's effective. And you do have to do that in the United States. That's the Food and Drug Administration. But in Australia, you also have to go through a second step. You have to go to a government-run committee that negotiates with the drug manufacturer about how much they're going to pay for that drug. And, you know, here's where you end up seeing a lot of trade-offs, where you'll see a lot of stories in the Australian press. In the United States press, you see a lot of stories about skyrocketing drug prices and, you know, drugs becoming unaffordable. In Australia, you'll see the really negative stories are about the government deciding it won't allow a certain manufacturer to sell a drug in Australia because it's too expensive. And so in Australia, they really have to make some hard decisions about, do we think this drug is worth the price the manufacturer wants? And if we don't, are we comfortable saying this drug is too expensive, our government-run healthcare plan isn't going to pay for it, and that we're not going to allow them to sell here? And, you know, the benefit is you end up with lower drug prices because you're negotiating prices with the manufacturers. The downside is if you're negotiating, you know, you have to be willing to say no, right? You're not a very good negotiator if you're going to say yes to every drug. You have to say no to certain drugs that where the manufacturers want to charge really high prices. And that's a hard trade-off that other countries are making, and we're not making that trade-off. But as a result, we have very high drug prices.
Wow. So if I lived in Australia and there was a medicine that I thought would really, really help me, but the Australian government said, no, Laura, that's not on our approved list because it's too expensive, you can't have it, then what do I do?
So one of the things that's also a little bit different about these other countries is they have some kind of nationalized healthcare system. So unlike the United States, where we're all getting coverage from a lot of different sources, Australia is, you know, running a national plan that Australian citizens are buying into. So basically what they're saying when, you know, Laura, this drug isn't covered, they're saying our insurance plan, which all Australians buy into, is not going to pay for this drug. So it's a tough situation. There are probably other drugs they want you to use in that case. You might, you know, if you're someone who's exceptionally wealthy, you know, try and buy the drug through some other means. But these are real trade-offs. I think we all like the idea of lowering drug prices. But, you know, one of the things I've really learned in reporting on this, if we want to lower drug prices, we need to bring muscle to the negotiating table. And the only way we do that is by being willing to say no. And then you do have these controversies that arise when there's certain drugs that are said no to that the government won't cover. And those are real problems. There's no easy solution to making sure everyone can have access to every drug they want at an affordable price always.
That's really interesting. And Sydney Lupkin, I'd love your thoughts, what you've observed on this sort of this tension that Sarah describes. You know, everybody wants lower drug prices, but then Americans don't want somebody saying, no, you can't have it.
Sure, but at the same time, I think it's also important to sort of keep in mind that if a drug is too expensive for you to afford, then you don't have it anyway. So, I mean, there's always the trade-off. The idea that this new drug that was approved, I don't think it was over the weekend, I think it was last week, for spinal muscular atrophy, which kills children before they turn two, a single dose caught. It was just approved. It's, you know, suddenly these kids that were going to die by age two can theoretically live, you know, a normal life, but they need to take this drug the rest of their life. But a single dose costs $125,000.
A single dose? And you have to take it every day?
No. You take, I believe, 5 to 6 doses in the first year, but that costs, you know, $750,000.
Yeah, who can afford that? Right.
Right. So, I mean, granted, insurance companies, you know, we have insurance, but how much of that is covered? What is the copay? There are charity programs that pay the copay, or sometimes the drug companies have their own patient assistant programs. But ultimately, that pays the copay. That pays, you know, a fraction of the cost of the drug. Who pays the rest of it? We do.
We do, meaning?
Meaning insurance companies are paying for it, but then we as a society are all paying into that insurance company, and that's going to mean higher premiums. So basically, we all pay the price of high drug prices, whether we do it in, usually it's indirectly, right? But again, you know, we want there to be this drug so these children can live past age two. So as Sarah was saying, it is a trade-off.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join us, and then a lot more to untangle with this. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at the price of prescriptions. Last year, pharmaceutical executives were in the hot seat, facing congressional outrage over the cost of life-saving drugs. President-elect Trump has promised action, but we're looking at what's behind these price tags, and if the government intervened to lower them, would there be unintended consequences, such as one of our guests described in Australia, where some drugs just are not widely available. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. What's your experience with this issue? What are your thoughts about how it might be fixed? You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Sarah, a lot of people don't pay the actual price. You know, there's coupons, there's discounts, there's special trials and so forth. How does that affect the sticker price of these drugs, Sarah?
Yeah, it's a really confusing market, right? Where, you know, you can't just go, like you might with aspirin on the shelf, go pick it up, see the price, pay it and walk out the store. There's a lot going on where a lot of people are paying a lot of different prices. One of the things we've really seen as we've seen the rise of drug prices is the rise of drug coupons, where companies will offer you some kind of discount to purchase their drug. And this can work in confusing and really maddening ways. One of the things you see a lot of are drug manufacturers who have a patented drug, and it's about to come off patent, but they really want people to keep buying that drug. They want people to buy their more expensive version rather than their new generic competitor. So one of the things they will often do is start issuing coupons. Say, if you buy this brand name drug, we'll cover your copay or we'll cover your coinsurance. This makes it cheaper for the consumer. It actually, like Sydney was saying, it makes it more expensive for everyone else because on the back end, your insurance company are still paying those much higher generic drug prices. So, you know, you're maybe skipping a $10 copay, but then on the back end, your insurance company is still paying, you know, a much higher price for that brand name drug. So I think this really speaks to how hard it can even be to know how much your drugs cost, since we're in a situation where most people have health insurance, they're paying some fraction of it. It can be really, really opaque. And I think that's another obstacle to lowering drug prices is we often don't really even know how much we're spending when we go to the pharmacy.
Right. It's like college. Nobody really pays the sticker price, but nobody really knows how much it costs. Let's go to our listeners, both of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We'd love your questions and comments this morning about the rising price of some prescriptions and why this system is so difficult to figure out, why you pay so much for one drug and so little for another. Let's go to Bruce in Londonderry. And Bruce, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I was calling is I don't use drugs, or very few drugs, mainly over the counter. But lately I've been listening, watching television the last 3 or 4 days, and every other commercial is an advertisement for some unpronounceable drug with usually a Q or an X in it. And they say, you know, is this drug right for you? And they tell you what every disadvantage of taking the drug is, like, you know, heart attack, death. But they don't really tell you whether the drug actually works any better than an aspirin.
So you're wondering about the advertising, Bruce, and whether that raises the price? Yeah.
How much that adds to the price, and how much it encourages people to go to their doctor and say, oh, I read about this, I heard about this drug on television. I need it.
Yeah, because the ad always says, ask your doctor. You know, thank you for the call, Bruce. And Sandy also sent us a Facebook comment with a similar idea that you had, Bruce. She says, plain and simple marketing costs. Prices started surging when pharma began excessive advertising of prescription drugs. Sydney, you want to take that one first?
Sure. I mean, advertising in the way that we're seeing it now, if you, remember 20 years ago, we didn't have these big pharma ads on television. It wasn't allowed. And now we see it all the time. It is definitely pushing drugs to, you know, it is pushing patients to go to their doctors and say, well, I heard about this. Should I be on this? Or even more so, the these reminder ads where, you know, it's a condition that we've never heard of and maybe we all have or maybe we don't. I don't know. Maybe we weren't diagnosed with it. But there's an ad that says, oh, well, does your, you know, something feel like something, horrible example. Does this hurt? Go to your doctor. Maybe you have this, and then maybe you can be on this drug. So that's sort of also a new thing that wasn't around a couple decades ago. In terms of how much it's driving up prices, I'm not entirely sure. I know that in terms of the cost of the advertising, whether that's built into the drug prices, maybe, but we should also sort of think about how much money pharmaceutical companies and health product companies are spending on lobbying, because they're spending, you know, I think for the last 10 years, they spent more than $200 million a year routinely. They're routinely the top lobbying industry in the country. So that's sort of influencing the laws, which is, you know, maybe another reason that another place that drug companies are spending money that's sort of outside of R&D.
That's interesting. So don't focus so much on the ad that you might see in a magazine or on television, but the sort of behind the scenes advertising, Sydney, if I could put it that way, the lobbying that goes on Capitol Hill.
Sure. So as I was saying, you know, this year it was the lowest in about 10 years. It was $186 million from pharmaceutical companies and health product companies, but that's a big player. So the 21st Century Cures Act that just passed before the holiday, pharmaceutical companies lobbied in a big way on that. And that did a lot for them in terms of speeding up processes and helping push the flexibility of how the FDA does its approval a little bit more.
All right.
So they're lobbying to get things done that are in their favor.
Well, that's real interesting. And coming up after a break, we should talk a little bit more about that, including, you know, public frustration with the FDA and how slow it is. Also, folks, we should look at the argument that pharmaceutical companies have long said that, hey, without the opportunity to charge a price that reflects the huge cost of investment and research, they wouldn't be able to create these, you know, fantastic breakthrough drugs that save lives. So we will talk about that, too, in just a moment. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the price of prescriptions. Last year, we saw pharmaceutical executives hauled before Congress in the hot seat facing grilling over the cost of life-saving drugs and how high some of these are. Also present, like Trump says he doesn't like what's happened with drug prices. He promises to lower them. We're looking at what's behind these price tags, and if government did intervene to lower them, would there be consequences that we haven't really thought about yet? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Why do you think drug prices are so high in this country? What are your own struggles with paying for high costs of medicine? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are two reporters in D.C. who've covered this issue for a long time. Sydney Lupkin, correspondent for Kaiser Health News, former health reporter for abcnews.com. Also Sarah Cliff, senior editor at vox.com and a former reporter with The Washington Post. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Sarah, I want to turn back to you, too, before we go to our listeners. What about the advertising that some people feel like is behind the high cost of drugs? What about the lobbying costs that Sydney mentioned that some of these companies spend so much on to make sure the laws are favorable?
Yes, I'd say, you know, to the listener who's asking about drug prices, he's right, it is unique. The United States and New Zealand are the only countries that allow direct consumer advertising for drugs. So it's not something you're going to see when you travel. It is a very American thing to see advertising for drugs. I think the research, there's a great video, if you're interested in learning more, that my colleague Joss Fong here at Vox made. You can find it on vox.com. It's a really great video about this issue of direct-to-consumer advertising for drugs. One thing she finds is that the research is quite mixed on whether this actually drives up drug prices. And in some cases, it's possible there are positive effects. There are some studies of recent ads for the HPV vaccine, Gardasil, which I think generally doctors want young girls to get, suggesting that these ads did increase patients talking to their doctors about Gardasil, which that's a drug I think we generally, you know, want girls to be getting. It's just kind of like a fine line, right, of what is good public health, what is just encouraging, like Sydney said, people to go to the doctor for drugs they might not need. I would actually add on a different type of spending that I think is more influential, which is advertising to doctors, where there is a lot of money spent on making presentations to doctors, going to doctor's office, talking about why you should prescribe this particular drug. A lot of this happened, if you kind of trace back the opiate epidemic, you see a lot of this happening for the companies that were manufacturing these opiate painkillers, really going to doctors, sending them videos, sending them patient testimony about why this drug was so great at curing pain. And I think the research is much stronger that these kind of drug reps, these lunches, trips, you know, anything ranging from free pens to vacations for doctors that pharmaceutical companies provide, I think those are a lot more influential in doctors' prescribing habits than the patient who comes in who saw an ad and wants to ask about.
That's interesting. Drug. So, Sarah, you know, people often say, hey, you know, what about these glossy ads and these beautiful commercials we see on television? And isn't that jacking up the price that I pay? But you're saying maybe yes, maybe no. It's a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think the evidence is a lot stronger that it's really the marketing to doctors that I find as a reporter more concerning, and I'm less concerned about the ads on television because I don't think – I think my understanding from watching – and again, this is from my colleague Joss Fong's great work. Her summary of the research shows people do ask about drugs more, but you don't really see – a huge increase in the types of prescriptions that doctors are making.
And Sydney, in states where doctors are encouraged to or allowed to use generics, somebody might come in and say, you know, I saw an ad for such and such. What do you think? The doctor might say, yeah, you know, that could help you, but here's a generic and it's a lot cheaper. So it's not necessarily that asking about that drug is going to encourage someone to use and to end up having somebody use that drug.
Sure, assuming that a generic exists.
Right, which right. In some cases they do, and some cases they don't. You're absolutely right. Let's go back to our listeners, both of you. And again, the number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns about high drug prices, 1-800-892-6477. Chris is in Nashua. Hi, Chris. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
So I have a question. I had heard that a significant, I don't know how much, but significant portion of pharmaceutical R&D and marketing budgets are actually spent on what I call Me Too drugs. So, for example, Viagra comes out, it was a blockbuster, and then somebody decides to get in on that gravy train, so they come up with Cialis and many other things. So that's all money, a lot of money, a big part of their budget spent on solving something that's already solved. So, you know, they could be focusing on male pattern baldness, for example.
Well, Chris, I appreciate it. No, it's a good point. And what about so-called Me Too drugs, Sydney? Do you know anything about that?
I don't know a ton about how much is spent on them. I can tell you that pharmaceutical companies are only spending about 10 to 20% of their revenue on research and development overall, and that's according to several studies that I had written about back in, I want to say, August, on our list of why drug prices are so high in the U.S. In terms of Me Too drugs, the thing to sort of keep in mind about them, if they're not generics, right? If they were a generic, they would bring the price down, and that means that it's the same, you know, molecule. These are different molecules that sort of do the same thing, which is why the prices are not coming down when they come out. They might come down a little bit because patients have options, but they're not going to come down like a generic drug price would come down.
Thank you for the call, Chris. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Here's an email from Amy who says, I have many friends in the industry, in research, development, sales, promotion, marketing, and have come to know that it's a very lucrative field in all aspects. I also know that the launch parties companies have can cost in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Amy says, I feel like these areas contribute greatly to the high cost of meds, drugs. Can this be addressed in some way to lessen the cost to consumers? Thank you, Amy, for the email. You know, Sarah, we do hear this, that, you know, drug prices are so high, I'm struggling to pay for my EpiPen or whatever. And then the executive makes, you know, a gazillion dollars. It kind of rubs people the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this kind of gets to another really important trade-off in drug pricing that I've covered. And it's this kind of trade-off between access and innovation. And there's an economist at Northwestern University, Craig Garthwaite, who I've talked to about this, who really shaped my views on this. And I think you often hear pharmaceutical companies saying, well, we need to charge these high prices so we can put that money into innovative drugs. And it feels like they're saying we need these profits so we can make new drugs. And that is really not the right way to think about this question. Craig, this economist I talked to, he kind of explained it to me in a way I found so helpful, where he says, you know, imagine you are an investor sitting down at your desk with this giant pile of money, and you are deciding, you know, should I invest in a social media app or should I invest in a drug? And one of the things that's going to be important to you is how much money you think you can make. Do you think you can make a lot of money making some like new iPhone app that people love, or do you think you can make a lot of money making a new medication? And so it's really the higher prices, there is good research to suggest that they do increase investment in pharmaceutical research. But, you know, there's a trade-off. And I think Sydney put it really well earlier that, you know, how much is innovation worth to us if we can't afford it? At some point, you know, I kind of think right now we're spending too much on innovation. Our prices are too high, and that's hurting access. And I would be fine with losing some innovation if it meant people had better access to the drugs we have now. And I think that's really, you know, and, you know, kind of speaks to this question about, well, what about these lavish parties? Why do they have to spend money on that? And I think, you know, the answer I come to, it's kind of this investor sitting at the table, and do they want to go into the industry where they can have these lavish parties and do these great things? And is that industry going to be pharmaceuticals? Is it going to be Silicon Valley? So I think, you know, it's not that companies are, you know, charging these high prices and then plowing that money back into a new drug. It's really about where is investment going to go in the economy. And it's tough. Like I said, it's another one of these really hard trade-offs. I don't think there's one right answer, but I think there is this tension between innovation and access that we're pretty high on the innovation side right now and very low on the access side.
So that's really interesting, Sarah. So again, you know, your average Joe or Jane, you know, our emailer included C's lavish parties, you know, maybe C's high CEO pay and says, hey, you know, I'm struggling to pay for my child's medicines or whatever. But you're saying investors, the people maybe even, you know, outside the companies are looking to invest for the biggest return. And to some extent, pharmaceutical companies have to promise a high price, at least for a limited period of time, so that those investors will dump money into this new research. Is that how it plays out?
Yeah, and you could say, as other countries have, like, we don't think it's worth it. Like, right now, this weird situation you've ended up with, because the United States does not regulate prices and investors can expect this massive return, the United States ends up shouldering the world's research and development budget. American consumers are paying much higher prices for drugs than anywhere else. And we are paying those prices into higher pharmaceutical profits that make pharmaceuticals a more lucrative investment industry. But to be clear, like, we are shouldering this burden for the rest of the world. Like, we are paying way more for the exact same drugs. And I think if the United States did decide to price regulate like other countries do, you would likely see less innovation. I don't know if other countries would step up and let pharmaceutical companies charge more so there's more money going into the industry. But there would be a trade-off there, and it would be a less desirable industry for investors in America, for investors from abroad to put their money in.
Right. So I know we can't really answer this question, but just to speculate. So, Sarah, the fear is, you know, people get upset, and understandably so. Americans are subsidizing everybody else who does get lower drug costs. But the concern then, Sarah, is if you really clamp down on prices in this country, you're also clamping down on innovation. And in the example I think Sydney gave us earlier, you know, there are exciting new drugs that are actually saving people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think, you know, how you feel about this, it might depend on who you are and what your situation is. Like, if you are someone with hepatitis C who wants treatment with Sovaldi, this drug that came on the market about 2 years ago and cost about $1,000 a pill. I forget the exact price of the course of treatment, but it was quite expensive. You might be someone who wants more price regulation because what's important to you right now is access. Like, you have a drug, you know it'll cure your hepatitis C, you just want the price to come down. If you are someone with a disease that has not yet been cured, you are probably someone who wants prices to be high so that there's more research put into pharmaceuticals, so that more money is flowing into the industry. So really where you sit, you know, what your particular healthcare issues will likely shape kind of how you think about this issue and what would be better. And you have, I mean, the thing that makes it so hard is you have people in both those situations. You have the people whose cures exist who can't afford them. You have the people whose cures don't exist and who want a lot of money going towards that research. And there is one right answer to, well, what's the way to balance the needs of those different people?
This is a really important point. Sydney, how do you sort of sort through this as a reporter, this important trade-off that Sarah is describing?
I mean, as a reporter, I think you just need to lay it all out there and explain that there is a trade-off. In terms of sort of research, the other thing to sort of keep in mind is that most research isn't starting at the big pharmaceutical company level. A lot of it is happening in academic laboratories funded by the NIH, which means it's taxpayer-backed grants and things like that. And then ultimately those companies hope to get bought by bigger pharmaceutical companies who can then bring them through the clinical trial phases, which is very expensive. So it's also on that end pretty complicated as well.
Well,
because if you figure, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's an important aspect of this that I hadn't thought of. So to say that if we don't allow companies to charge these really high prices, all research will dry up. Sydney, you're saying not necessarily. A lot of the research goes on at, you know, NIH, for example, or the publicly funded research institutions in other countries as well.
Right. A lot of it is not necessarily at NIH, mm-hmm. though I'm sure it goes on there as well. But for instance, just to go back to this 21st Century Cures Act that passed in December, one of the things that it did was it said, let's add money to the NIH so that it can go toward cancer research and precision medicine and research on the brain. And that's going to ultimately trickle down to different academic institutions, which will then do the research on that sort of oftentimes early level, where if you think about it, that's, you know, cells in petri dishes, and then it's rodent studies, and then it's larger mammal studies, and then it gets to clinical trials. So it has to go, you know, a ways back. And oftentimes that's funded by the NIH.
All right. Back to our listeners, both of you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we talk about the price of prescription drugs in this country and why they are higher compared to everybody else. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email exchange at nhpr.org. And Jillian is calling from Hudson. Hi, Jillian. You're on the exchange. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I want to say I was pleasantly surprised to hear Sarah on. I'm a big fan of the Weeds podcast. But my question is basically, you know, we've heard a lot from politicians about how mandates on what insurance, health insurance needs to cover can increase the cost of insurance. But I'm wondering how, you know, getting rid of some of those mandates might impact the cost of drugs.
That's a really important point, and we haven't talked yet about the role of insurance, what it'll cover and what it won't. Maybe do you first, Sydney, on that one, how insurance decisions affect the price of prescription drugs?
Sure. So basically, our biggest sort of pool of people, unlike other countries where we have, you know, this sort of national healthcare system, we have a much more fragmented system where we have, you know, your individual plans and your pharmacy benefits managers. And then we have our sort of larger negotiators, which are going to be publicly funded healthcare, which is Medicare, Medicaid. Medicare is not allowed to negotiate prices. So that's, you know, Sarah might know the number, and now it's totally escaping me. I think it's 40 million people are on Medicare and Medicaid. Someone needs to, I'm not sure if that's correct. I apologize.
I think it's like 50 million Medicare, 70 million Medicaid, I want to say.
Oh, great. Wonderful. So it's a lot of people. And Medicare, when Medicare Part D, when it was created in 2003, barred from negotiating drug prices. So if you can't negotiate the drug prices, you know, basically what happens is the drug companies were finding, again and again, they're setting it at what the market will bear. It's based on basically how much are consumers willing to pay. And that's what's driving our health. That's part of the reason that our healthcare or our drug prices are so expensive, because they're not negotiated. Now, one of the solutions that has been proposed again and again is, well, what if we could negotiate Medicare Part D? But as far as I've been told, that's unlikely that that's going to happen, especially now with our Republican Congress and with so much pharma lobbying. Probably unlikely to happen in the near future.
Well, and that's interesting, because I think, Sarah, I read in your piece at Vox that while Medicare, as Sydney says, can't negotiate lower drug prices, Medicaid requires a discount of about 20%, and the Veterans Administration, which also covers a lot of Americans, can negotiate. Is that right, Sarah?
Yeah, no, that is accurate. And I think also thank you for listening to the Weeds, this podcast I host. So glad we have some listeners in New Hampshire. And so I think, yes, the Veterans Administration, they can negotiate. And I think it really lays bare, you know, what would be different if Medicare negotiated as well. Two things are notable about the Veterans Administration. They have much lower drug prices than Medicare. That's the effect of negotiating. They get the same drugs, the exact same pills for Medicare. They pay less for them. But they also have a much smaller formulary.
I'm so sorry. I got to cut you off there. We're going to take a short break. I'll let you pick that up in just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, we're looking once again at the price of prescription drugs, why they're so high in this country. And as we're learning, it's complicated. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests for the hour are two reporters from D.C. who've been looking at this issue for a long time. Sydney Lupkin is a correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and Sarah Cliff is senior editor at Vox.com, where she oversees health, medicine, and education coverage. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, lots of people want to jump into our conversation, but Sarah, just before the break, I had to cut you off. We were talking about how while Medicare can't negotiate down drug prices with pharmaceutical companies, and some people say that's a problem, Medicaid does have a lower rate, And the Veterans Administration has a lower rate. So go ahead and finish that up there, Sarah.
Yeah. So I'm saying the Veterans Administration, they pay a lot less for the same drugs that Medicare buys. The trade-off is they cover a lot less drugs than Medicare covers. So if you are someone getting your coverage through the VA, I've actually heard cases of veterans who they still buy Medicare Part D because Medicare Part D will cover more drugs. And I think it speaks to the trade-off we were discussing earlier, where if you are going to negotiate drug prices, you also tend to scale back the mandate of how many drugs you have to cover. And this is the result of lowering drug prices, but also saying there are fewer drugs that the insurance company is willing to pay for.
Here's an email from Beth that just came in, who says, how can you say that drugs need to be expensive to fund research when countries like Israel have amazing research and new drugs coming out but have low drug costs? Beth, by the way, we weren't saying that companies need to do this. We were quoting the companies who say that they need to do this. So just to make sure you're straight on that. But talk a little bit more about that, Sydney, if you could, please. Again, the idea that research is happening everywhere and it doesn't necessarily have to lead to high prices.
Sure. I mean, I think just to understand that a little bit better, when we say, you know, when research happens, when we say that, I guess the U.S. is sort of subsidizing research in the whole world, we mean that, you know, investors who are looking to launch drugs and turn a big profit, they're launching those drugs all over the world, and in the U.S. they know they're going to make the bulk of their profit, and that sort of pushes companies, venture capital, people to invest in drugs because they know that even though it might not make as much money in Israel, it's going to make a lot when they bring that drug to the U.S. So that's sort of what we mean by that.
Well, Beth, thank you for the email. Again, it's exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go next to Bill in Amherst. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I wanted to say was that what Austin seems to be missing from this conversation is that there are alternatives to pharmaceutical drugs, namely those kinds of supplements and homeopathic remedies that are prescribed by naturopathic doctors. And these can be just as effective as pharmaceuticals at much less cost. And it seems that one of the impediments to a lot of these alternative medications is that they are not covered by insurance.
Yeah.
And so if, you know, if the insurance company were to open their eyes maybe a little bit, I think they could save a lot of money. And I think that could be true of Medicare and other government agencies that cover drugs. Costs.
Well, Bill, thank you for the call. And now both of you, I know this is maybe a little bit outside your purview, but Sydney, there has been a lot of back and forth on how much insurance companies should cover alternative medicine. Bill's right. Some people find a lot more relief from more natural alternatives than traditional drugs, you know, and then NIH has a whole institute, I think, for alternative medicine. But we've kind of gone back and forth on this, Sydney.
Sure. So, I mean, in terms of alternative medicines, those are, you know, there are definitely some patients who swear by them, and they are studied. But I think it depends on your condition, right? So this drug that was just approved to treat spinal muscular atrophy that kills children by age 2, I mean, that's not necessarily going to be a patient who can have something that's homeopathic. So it all sort of depends on, I think, what your ailment is. In terms of whether insurance companies cover them, this is a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but I'm sure that what they're looking for is, you know, certain studies that show that when they're covering something, that it's really going to be beneficial. So maybe the answer is more research.
And sometimes that research is hard to come by.
Right. I mean, the thing is with supplements, they're not explicitly approved by the FDA like drugs. So they don't go through those phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials that maybe insurance companies are looking for to really guarantee that something is going to be beneficial to their patients. So I think that may also sort of be because of the way they're regulated, there's less research, perhaps, because it's not, you know, forced. And then maybe, so it might actually go back to before the insurance companies. Perhaps if they were regulated differently, the research would be there and the insurance companies would be more likely to get on board. But I'm just sort of hypothesizing because
sure.
this is a little bit outside of my area.
Well, Bill, we appreciate the call. Thank you. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Sarah, you've written that political attention has been rising on this topic. And again, in 2016, we all saw these pharmaceutical executives being hauled before committees on Capitol Hill, being grilled about the high costs of drugs, especially EpiPen, but there have been others. Sarah, what's been the effect of all that negative coverage?
Not a lot, to be honest. So I had actually expected, if we had a Clinton presidency, that this was an issue her campaign really seemed to be gearing up to talk about. I had thought if Clinton won the election that we would be having a very serious drug pricing debate in 2017, and that would kind of be a continuation of the work that the Obama administration started on expanding coverage, that the healthcare debate would switch to healthcare costs and spending. That all changed on November 8th. It seems like all the healthcare attention is going to be taken up with repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, and I just don't expect a lot of political attention to be put towards regulating drug prices when they have so many other healthcare issues on their agenda, and the Republicans have been quite clear that Obamacare repeal is really agenda item number one.
Well, and you wrote that while Sovaldi, again, this is a high-profile, very important, but very expensive drug, you wrote, Sarah, while Sovaldi became a poster child for pharmaceutical greed, it brought the company Gilead and its shareholders a hefty profit. So you kind of seem to be saying that, you know, these companies, it was bad press for the public, but when it came to shareholders and investors, they just kind of wrote it out and it ended up being okay for them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the kind of lesson I've taken is if you kind of keep your head down as a pharma company, you try and not get much attention, you can get away with some pretty high prices. The kind of opposite of this is, it was a year or two ago, Martin Shkreli, the pharmaceutical executive who hugely increased the price of a generic medication that his company was the only one manufacturing and was quite bombastic about it, was on Twitter, was, you know, doing these web videos, was really, you know, wanted to talk about how much he was raising the price and how he wasn't going to change it. And he got a ton of blowback, you know, was under investigation. So I think if you want to make a giant deal over increasing your drug prices, that's going to draw attention.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're making drugs like Sovaldi, at the time when Sovaldi came out, it was the only cure for hepatitis C. You can really get away with charging a lot for such an innovative drug that is really going to change a lot of people's lives.
Doesn't seem like good PR, Sarah, to go on Twitter and brag about how much you're going to charge for a medicine that helps people in an extremely difficult situation.
Yes, I think so long as you're not going to go on a Twitter rant, and I think the pharma trade group here in D.C. was very quick to distance themselves from Martin Shkreli. Say he's not a member of pharma, he doesn't represent our views. But if you are you know, willing to keep your head low, I think you can get away with some pretty high prices.
Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's another angle to this that we haven't talked about yet. This is an email from Anna in Peterborough. She says, another issue I hope you'll touch on is prescription meds that become over-the-counter. Anna says, insurance does not pay for over-the-counter meds, so it becomes an expense. For people on limited incomes, it adds to the dilemma of, do I eat, pay the rent, buy meds? Every time a med becomes available without a prescription, Anna says, it gets publicized as a good thing, but I see my clients struggling to figure out how or if they will continue to take it and what harm will result from stopping. Anna, thank you so much. You know, I think she's right, Sydney, when we hear that, you know, Claritin, for example, I think is now over the counter, the allergy drug. It used to be only by prescription. We hear that and we go, that's a good thing. Anna seems to be saying not all the time.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I'm not sure. That's an interesting point for sure. I don't know. I haven't seen anything that's, you know, in the realm of $100 for something over the counter, but maybe. And I'm also not so sure. You know, I'm just going to list a couple of things I don't know about. But basically, I mean, she's making an interesting point. I do wonder, once something goes over the counter, how long, depending, I suppose it would depend on its patent, but how long you can, it will take to get that sort of, you know, Walgreens brand Claritin, which could, you know, bring the price down a little bit for consumers. I don't know how long that usually takes, but that could be, you know, one helpful alternative.
Okay. Well, Anna, thank you for the email. Here's another one that just came in. No name attached to this one. Why not regulate the industry as the public utility that it really is? This person says the amount of profit permitted above expense of research and production would be fixed and contained. He or she also says it would be great to limit the amount of advertising to consumers, though pigs will fly before that happens. Both TV and Tiny Media could not afford to lose that revenue. Advertising to the consumer of prescription medications has no useful purpose. Now, we talked about this a little bit before, but Sarah, go ahead. Why not regulate the industry as the public utility that it really is? It just doesn't seem like that's politically feasible in this country.
Yeah, I think it really, it does come down to politics. And, you know, every other developed country has made the decision to regulate drug prices. The United States is pretty exceptional in that we have not created that sort of policy. And there's other ideas too floating out there. There's some really interesting policy ideas. I think actually from Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont has some ideas about reframing drug price as a series of large prizes from the government. So you'd have this incentive to innovate. You'd offer like a large price for a drug, a large prize for a drug we really want. A manufacturer would make it, you'd give them the prize money, and then the patent would belong to the government, and they could just produce the medication incredibly cheaply. So that's another idea for not regulating drug prices, but at least regulating a little bit how much they cost. But there just does not seem to be much political appetite to take this on, and it goes back to, you know, what Sydney was saying, that pharmaceuticals are quite strong lobby here in Washington. And, you know, I covered the Affordable Care Act debate in 2009. And I think there was, in 2008, you heard then Senator Barack Obama in his run for the presidency talking about how he was going to regulate drug prices. But as soon as he gets into office, starts working on health reform, he realizes that the pharmaceutical industry is so powerful that they can sink health reform if they are opposed to it. So that's a concession he makes. He decides that the healthcare law is not going to attempt to regulate drug prices. And that kind of takes us to where we are today.
Well, right. And I think you wrote about this in your article, Sarah, that, you know, the Affordable Care Act, you know, did a good job maybe expanding access, but not so much lowering cost. I understand that the ACA, you know, gives makers of biologic drugs 12 years of protection from generic competition. So, you know, President Obama needed buy-in from the drug makers, but you seem to be saying he gave up on that goal of reducing drug prices.
Yeah, I think there was not really, I think it's fair to say there was not really a serious effort at constraining drug prices in the Affordable Care Act. I will say one of the things the administration has been quite good at is releasing data on drug spending and drug pricing. The current administrators of Medicare and Medicaid really have done a fantastic job at least telling us these prices, which help us understand, you know, what drugs are spending the most on, which drugs are increasing a lot year to year. So there really was not a serious attempt in the ACA to regulate drug prices, but we at least have a lot more information. And because Medicare covers so many people, we can actually really get a sense of like, what are these handful of drugs that are really driving the very fast and high cost growth in drug spending.
Let's take one more call, both of you. And Mike is in Concord. Hi, Mike. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? So I have MS. I was diagnosed about a year ago with it, multiple sclerosis. And before that, I was on sort of a medical sharing program. So I wasn't part of the Affordable Care Act. I was covered from the fine or tax for my other insurance. But the MS drug, it seems like no matter which drug it is, they're about $6,000 per month.
Wow, it's a lot of money, Mike.
It sure is. So I ended up jumping onto the Obamacare and open enrollment last year to cover that. My medical sharing program covered 3 months of the medicine. My question or my comment is I wonder if the Affordable Care Act sort of takes drug prices off the news a little bit, because less people are, you know, more people are covered, less people are paying the prices. It's not my problem anymore. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, Mike. So how's your situation now in terms of being able to afford these very important drugs for you? And I'm sorry to hear about your condition.
No, thanks. No, everything's fine with it. But no, I afford it fine with my exchange plan, and I have a really high deductible, but my medical sharing program makes that up. And actually, the drug companies, every single one of the MS drug makers, whatever your copay is, they magically have a copay funding program to pay for it, no matter what your income is. So I don't pay out of pocket at all. But I'm one of those people who, you know, I cost $80,000 a year to an insurance company, and it doesn't impact me because I have my drugs.
Sure.
So the price of the drug doesn't really bother me, if that makes sense.
Well, Mike, good luck to you. Yeah. I'm glad you called in, and Sydney, we're nearing the end of the hour. I apologize, but he's touching on something that people do say also raises the cost of drugs, is that a lot of folks are shielded from the high cost through their insurance.
Right. I mean, what does a drug – I mean, it's very hard to figure out, you know, how much your drug actually costs unless you're looking at sort of these itemized bills at sometimes. Actually, I'd spoken to another patient who had MS and said that her her drug was also a $6,000 a month copay. But when she went on Medicare, or maybe it was Medicaid, either one, the – charity programs aren't able to pay your copay because of anti-kickback legislation. So she had a really hard time when that happened. And it's definitely, you know, not a problem that necessarily goes away, even if you're shielded from it by, you know, these copay assistance programs.
Well, Mike, good luck to you, and thank you for the call. And Sarah and Sydney, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you both so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having
Thank
me.
Thank you.
Sarah Cliff, senior editor at Vox.com, and Sydney Lupkin, correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. We're also on Instagram at NHPR Exchange. You can check it out for some fun behind-the-scenes pictures of what we're up to. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.